And we are about to talk to someone whose work I have admired for a very long time. Former senior writer at Sports Illustrated, one of the best long-form journalists, I think, of our time, Alexander Wolfe. And we're going to talk about his the reissue of his book, Big Game, Small World, A Basketball Adventure, just recently re-released by Duke University Press. Alex, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Bruce. It's great 20 years later to be talking about this book all over again.
Well, yeah, and I was trying to figure out why I missed it the first time around, and I realized I was probably, when it came out, I was in graduate school and just starting to teach at the university, and I guess I was busy because it's the kind of book that I love. I said to Rich off air, and I told him I would definitely mention it on here, it reminds me of the best of W.C. Hintz, the kind of sports writing that takes sports and then uses it to take us into a world that we don't know. And that's what I loved about each one of these essays. But I want to know, what was the real genesis the first time 20 years ago when you decided we're going to start to put this together?
Boy, well, there had to be a globalization of the game. That process had to really begin. And boy, if you look in the early 80s, it really hadn't. I remember the Phoenix Suns had some big Bulgarian guy for a season, but he got Stolichnaya elbow and got drummed out of the league pretty quickly. But by the 90s, 92, certainly with the Dream Team going to Barcelona, what happened the 6, 7, 8 years after that, and I got to take the measure of, was kind of the backwash from that wave, the Dream Team hitting Barcelona, and just the excitement around the world. And for a moment there, certainly among that young generation, it seemed like basketball had overtaken soccer. So by the end of the 90s, Jordan had his run with the Bulls and won all those titles, and you could go to the most remote village in China and people there would be wearing Bulls hats because of Michael. There was something to write about. So that plus a book about soccer that I'd read called Football Against the Enemy, by a young British journalist who's been with the Financial Times for a long time since then and written wonderful things about soccer, named Simon Cooper. And I read that book and said, yeah, now this is something I could sink my teeth into. Assignments for the magazine allowed exposure for me to some of these germinating stories, but it took taking a leave of absence to hit the road and do this.
Well, in the new edition of the book, you point out that in the 2021 Olympics, there were 53 players with NBA experience playing for non-US teams. And when I think back to when I first started watching basketball with Oscar Robertson and Bob Cousy and the like, I don't think there was anybody except maybe a Canadian or two that had snuck in the league. What do you think, besides Jordan and the intelligent way that the NBA has marketed itself worldwide, what else makes this game so appealing in remote places?
Well, remember, within 10 years after it was invented in 1891, by the early 1900s, certainly by 1910 or 12, because the game had been invented at a training school for missionaries, these missionaries took, along with their Bibles, Naismith's original 13 rules, all over the country. The game was in China, literally, by the mid-1905, 1906. And in fact, Naismith loved to collect stories about all the far-flung places people would see hoops. And then Mao came along and you had the Cultural Revolution, but he'd already been exposed to basketball, didn't think it was this insidious Western influence. So hoops got a pass. And that happened in so many other countries. I think the simplicity of the game, it's easy to throw a hoop up in a building or in a schoolyard. It's just such a simple game. Even in countries where soccer would remain the preeminent sport, the infrastructure for people to play it, once they got a glimpse of Jordan, for instance, through satellite TV, it was there. And that kind of helped the rocket fuel.
One of the earliest essays in the book, and it blew me away. I've been to Springfield College and to Kansas University with the Sport Literature Association, and I've been to the Naismith sites on those campuses and have read a lot about Naismith and seen and heard papers. But Duck on a Rock was not anything I had ever heard of before. And if you could just sort of explain that and explain how that led you down other Naismith paths, that'd be great.
Well, the Great Naismith Pilgrimage, which you haven't done, most people haven't done, and I felt really fortunate to finally be able to do, is to his birthplace in Ontario. And there is a boulder there, the original rock on which the Duck on a Rock was played. So kids in rural Canada would take a small rock and put it on a huge boulder, and then they would go find even smaller rocks that they would throw at that rock on the boulder. And the idea was you were trying to knock the rock, the duck, off of the boulder, hence Duck on a Rock. And there was a little element to the game where you had to retrieve the smaller rock you threw at the duck and try to go back to some sort of home base before, you know, a certain amount of time elapsed, or beat your opponent back to home base. But in playing Duck on a Rock, Naismith remembered there was this kind of optimal arc that you always sought to achieve, where you balanced kind of force with accuracy. And you and I can sit here, you know, 130 years later, whatever, and see the brilliance, the sort of optimization between those two obligations, and how that applied to the perfectly arching jump shot. So in this all-nighter Naismith pulls in December of 1891 in his office, where he has to come up with the rules for this new indoor game, this is going through his head. So his rugby training up at McGill, where they would have to run through the gymnasium and toss underhanded a rugby ball into a carton on the ground. And then Naismith had the brilliant idea of, oh, we need to elevate that goal in order to keep the physicality of rugby at bay. And that was the great problem with rugby in those days, was how violent it was. So you just see how all these ideas were percolating in Doc Naismith's head.
Well, the other thing I found fascinating was that Naismith had to do up his original 13 rules, and he sends it to a woman in South America, and she misinterprets some of his diagrams, and we end up with that early version of women's basketball.
That's right. The three offense, three defense, never shall a woman pass midcourt, for God forbid, her tender sensibilities be violated. And to me, even more amazing is that persisted certainly in the state of Iowa well into the 60s and maybe even the 70s, if I'm not mistaken. And boy, when you watch the WNBA today, if you watch Cindy Blodgett just not so long ago in your great state, you know, you never believed that people thought that way once upon a time.
Or that my grandmother and my wife both played under those rules at different times. My wife was in high school in Rhode Island for a brief period of time. They had that. There's a wonderful book by Lydia Reeder called The Dust Bowl Girls about basketball, early basketball in Oklahoma, and where missionaries brought the game. And I always think of that when I think of these rules, and I think about Title IX and everything that's changed and how basketball has changed, which means it brings me to another one of the chapters, and that is the chapter about Shelley Pennefather. Am I saying that correctly? Pennefather or Pennefather?
Pennefather, you got it.
Pennefather. Yeah. That was perhaps as remarkable as any, her story, a very good college basketball player who decides to become a cloistered nun with the poor Clares. Could you talk a little bit about that for our readers? I really want people to... I want everybody to buy this book, so I'm trying to throw every angle to get them to buy it.
Shelley Pennefather wasn't just a really good player. She was the best college player in the country in 1980. I want to say it was 86 at Villanova. She won the Wade Trophy, the Heisman of women's basketball. And she came from a very devout Catholic family. And in the several years after she finished her time at Villanova, where she was, you know, Big East Player of the Year, who knows how many points she scored, she had the opportunity to play professionally in Japan and made a very handsome living there. I think she played three seasons, and she'd come back in the summers after having spent a fairly lonely time as a mercenary overseas, feeling kind of directionless. And she actually knocked on the door of a place up in the Philadelphia area. She grew up in Northern Virginia, but she went up to the Philly area where she knew that the order that Mother Teresa had been working with. and volunteered herself. And she caught Mother Teresa's eye because she was 6'4". She ended up going through a lengthy discernment process that led her to believe that she was called to be not just a nun, but a cloistered one who devotes the entirety of every day to prayer. And none of her friends, these teammates at Villanova, her family embraced it, but friends had a really hard time accepting it. And her coach, Harry Peretto, was kind of torn, but because he was a devout Catholic too and was kind of in awe of this wonderful former player of his, the decision that she had made. But she's still there. Every 20 years, her family's allowed to give her an embrace at the renewal of her vows. And since this book came out more than 20 years ago, there's been another moment where the Pentafather family has been able to go and see Sister Rose, as she's now called, and Harry Peretta, her coach at Villanova, too. So it's just one tale in the game. And I try to use her story as a way to get into basketball and kind of the beyond. Yes, I was able to write about the game in Japan, for that's where Shelley played. But there was also this kind of mysticism of the practice of the shot. She was a fabulous shooter. And just kind of the limits of how someone, even as adept at the game as Shelley was, there were limits to how much it could satisfy her. And she found this other path.
Well, and I wanted to talk about that because the part of the book that moved me beyond belief was the parts of the book in the Balkans. I remember being on a train in the summer of 1969 in Yugoslavia, then Yugoslavia, and the four Yugoslavians asking me, who were sitting across the way, why in American football is the big peel all the time on ground? And then when I figured out he was saying pile, I started explaining American football to him as best I could. One of them said, but I don't understand in America why you hate people. There are people you hate, black people you hate. In Yugoslavia, no one hates. We love everyone, Serb, Croat, and they're telling me this wonderful story and how Tito has made everything come together. And yet the vicissitudes and the bloodletting in the Balkans is some of the most, for me, horrifying stuff I've ever heard of. You write about a group of guys that were tight and they were different and they were from Yugoslavia and they weren't all from the same religion. They weren't all from the same ethnic background. That war ends up sundering those friendships in a remarkable way. And I was wondering if you could spend some time describing, first of all, how your original embrace of these people and meeting them and like was it, and what it's like to think about that today.
Yeah, boy, there's so much in there, Bruce, to revisit, to unpack. Really, the very first international assignment I got at Sports Illustrated was before the '84 Olympics, and it included going to Zagreb to see to report about Yugoslavia as a potential rival of the U.S. Olympic team in advance of LA '84, but also to catch, because I happened to be there at the time, the final of the Yugoslav League between Red Star Belgrade and Sabona Zagreb. So the two big rivals, one Serb team, one Croat team. I got a little exposure to it. And then, you know, like a lot of Americans, you kind of keep an eye on the news, but you don't quite understand when you see in the early 90s that this country is coming apart, what's going on. And actually, it was pursuing a lot of the reporting in the two chapters about the Balkans, which originated at the European Championships when the country had fallen apart and Croatia played the rump of Yugoslavia, which was essentially Serbia at that point. In a European Championships game, and then the Croatians walked off the podium rather than stand there alongside the champion Serbs. And I used that as a way to sort of talk about, gee, back in 1987, as juniors in the World Junior Championships, you had Dino Raja, you had Vlade Divac, you had players of all, Tony Kukoc, all ethnic backgrounds from the former Yugoslavia playing as a united Yugoslav team. They were great friends. All made their way to the NBA, but why could they suddenly not play together? Why was simply fraternizing on the court something none of them would engage in because we were afraid the games being beamed back home would show them doing that and their families would get reprisals as a result? And the irony of what you were hearing in that train compartment back in the late 60s, is that, you know, maybe in Tito's Yugoslavia, these differences didn't mean anything, but they were only being papered over. And all it took was a strong man to play on those ancient ethnic differences and surface all this stuff. And I'm happy to say I did write little codas to each of the chapters.
They're
to
great.
Try to update readers on 20 years is a long time. And one of the things that did happen in the intervening 20 years is Divac and Kukoc participated in something called Basketball Without Borders, which was a FIBA and UN and NBA joint effort to bring to go into conflict areas and try to use basketball to build bridges. And yeah, that's a small step. Things like that have been tried in the Middle East with middling success. But there was just so much poignancy in that whole story. And I hang a lot of it on this one coach I had become friendly with, a Serb, but a native of Sarajevo, and thus someone, Svetislav Pesic is his name, someone who was just appalled at all this. And he had been the coach of these juniors. He had been the coach of Kukoc and Oraja and when these guys were teenagers in total innocence. And the idea that some sort of civil war was going to test their friendship and bring about the destruction of their country just seemed the farthest from anybody's mind. So it was the real world, where the real world intersected with basketball, and I really wanted to explore it.
Well, I don't suppose there's any place I would less likely have thought you would have traveled than Bhutan to see if you could play a one-on-one against or in a pickup game against the king. That's a fabulous story. And as someone who has studied Eastern religions and stuff when I was in college and know a little bit about that culture, I was amazed to think, wow, they're really into basketball there.
They're really into it. The royal family is particularly into it. But if you've studied that culture, you also know it's very hierarchical.
Yes.
The king of Bhutan is a deity in the particular strain of Buddhism that they practice there. And the idea that some Westerner would simply swan into the capital and expect to show up on the doorstep of the palace and challenge the king to a game of one-on-one, I probably violated every possible protocol in their culture. But it was a fun conceit to use as I went there. You know, how can I get this audience with His Majesty? And in the course of just failing at that, I heard so many wonderful stories about how the NBA had penetrated even this fortress of a kingdom in the Himalayas. I mean, the king had the Bhutanese mission to the United Nations gather up all these videotapes of NBA highlights and send them to a diplomatic pouch so he could enjoy them with the royal bodyguards. So I filled my notebook and I was able to write it up as just kind of this futile chase, but there was so much fun to it that it was worth every moment.
Well, I cannot tell you what a great privilege and pleasure it's been to talk to you today. And I want people to go out and buy Big Game, Small World, A Basketball Adventure, because we've been doing Sports Lit here for 8 years. And we always say a book that's about sports and so much more is the book you want. This is the book you want, and you can get it for someone before Christmas if you go out there and get it today. Alex, thank you so very much for being with us, and we hope we can talk to you again sometime soon.
Thank you, Bruce. I really appreciate it, spending the time with you. Take care.
Take care now. That's Alexander Wolf and his book, Big Game, Small World, A Basketball Adventure. You won't read a better sports book, I promise you.